This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy. This is iFanboy Pick of the Week, episode 829, brought to you by iFanboy listeners just like you. Fanboy Pick of the Week, episode 829. My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and this is my co-host, Josh Flanagan.
Hey, that's me.
And joining us this week in the third chair is Dr. Ryan Haupt.
Thanks for keeping the third chair warm, Paul, with your Multiverse of Madness talk. Appreciate it. But I'm here now. It's time to talk comics.
He was actually in the fourth chair.
There's another chair?
Yeah. It's a multiverse of chairs. We are iFanboy, and every week we read our comics, and one of us picks our favorite book called The Pick of the Week. We talk about that book. And other books of the week, patron pick, other things. This week we're going to skip listener mail for a special segment, and here's your spoiler warning. Exercise some caution, because things might be spoiled. This week, Ryan had the pick.
I did, and this was a particularly difficult choice for me. A lot of really strong contenders, no one clear standout. I kind of ended up narrowing it down to two books, and then I realized that the theme between the two books was difficult decisions about fatherhood, and that's something that's been on my mind, obviously, because I have a kid now, and one of them was a more hopeful, forward-looking view on the subject, and the other was a really dark and depressing one, and after the week I've had, I went dark and depressing, so it is time after time. Number 12, story by Declan Shalvey.
It's actually time before time.
Time before time. Man, I even got it wrong in the script. It's my own pick. The pick was Time Before Time, number 12, a title that I think was chosen to be purposely confusing, in which case they have succeeded. They being Declan Shalvey and Rory McConville doing the story. Rory McConville doing the story. Art by PJ Holden. Colors by Chris O'Halloran. And letters
Ryan,
by Hassan.
Ryan, we're not going anywhere. You take a breath.
Yeah. I don't have time. There's no time. The letters were done by Hassan Otsame Elhau, I think.
I think you're 0 for 5 on that whole roster.
Yeah. Should I start over? Go back?
No, this is funny.
Time jump. All right. I chose this because I've been sticking with this series all the way through. I don't always understand what's going on, but this issue takes a break from our main characters who've been running around the time stream, and there's like these two rival time crime based organizations that are getting up to stuff in different time periods. I can't keep any of that straight. The reason that I really like this issue though is that it was a little more linear in that it followed The FBI agent who's been going around with the criminals, Nadia, she has disappeared from her home timeline. And the story follows her partner, who seems to be the only one who cares that she's disappeared. And what I didn't realize about this world, and so I thought this issue did some particularly good world building, is it tells us, the reader, that it's only the criminals that have access to these time machines. And the rest of society doesn't know that time travel is happening behind the scenes, and a lot of it is being used for criminal purposes. And so we kind of realize that along with her partner character, because he starts looking for her. It starts with them having a conversation about his wife becoming pregnant and him becoming a father. And then it jumps forward to when he has a kid and Nadia has disappeared. And his boss at the FBI doesn't seem interested in putting any resources into finding this lost partner in a way that is very confusing to him. So he starts looking into it on his own. He starts finding some weird stuff. He ends up at the docks where the syndicate criminal organization is loading up some stuff. He suspects that something is off and he brings one of them in. And in doing so, kind of inserts himself into this time-traveling criminal enterprise. One of the FBI techs that he works with notices that a candy bar from one of the crates hasn't been produced in over 100 years. I assume this is a future where chocolate has gone extinct, which is probably something that's going to happen in our lifetimes. So look forward to that.
It'll be true. Fake chocolate. It'll be like The Expanse. It'll taste like seaweed, they'll still be on the shelves.
So the agent's boss keeps kind of trying to tell him, like, dude, leave this alone. Don't mess with it. You know, when he brings in the guy from the docks, like, the lawyer is there before the FBI agent can even get back to the station. So it's like, wow, he got here really quickly. Like, gee, wonder why. And so that's when I started to realize, like, oh, the FBI doesn't know that time travel is happening. And so he ends up, you know, getting told off the case by his boss and getting put on leave. And he goes home and he's having trouble with his family because he's spending so much time worrying about his partner. And he doesn't have this great relationship with his wife and kid. And it's all very strained. And then the crime guys call him in and to a back alley meeting. And they have a guy strapped to a chair and they pull the pillowcase off his head. And it's his son from the future. And they're like, stop looking into this now, or your son dies in front of you. And his son has like a very specific birthmark on his face, so he can tell that it's his kid. And the guy realizes that he's in way in over his head. And the issue kind of ends with him just deciding, okay, I guess I got to play ball and just pretend not to notice that all this time stuff is happening, because my son's life is on the line. And his boss is like, yep, happened to me a couple of years ago. Tried to keep you out of it. Sorry. Like, you're in it with me now. And we just got to keep our heads down and keep on, you know, your partner's on her own and we can't do anything to help her, and good luck. And that's it. And it's like very bleak, dark ending. And I was like, wow, that was really good. It was really well told.
Josh, are you still on this book?
No, and I feel bad about it because I liked it. But Connor, you jumped early. And then I was having a hard time holding on. And then over one of the breaks or whatever, I built up like 3 issues or so. And I went back in because it had been some time, and I went, I had no idea what's going on. I'm going to let it go. It was, you know, one of those weeks. And I liked what was there, but I think that they had a hard time getting there. You know, even Ryan, you said, you know, I don't even know what's going on half the time. So it sounds like you are talking right now about the issue that I was waiting for. It sounds like, to a certain extent.
I think if this had been a continuation of the story they'd been telling in the previous 11 issues, I don't think this would have been anywhere close to a pick of the week contender, but I think the fact that it was kind of a standalone, almost a one shot about something that was happening kind of on the sidelines with that isn't the main characters we've been following, and the fact that it was just this really bleak, it reminded me a lot of Looper, the Rian Johnson.
Every time we talk about this, I see, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt and fake Bruce Willis makeup.
It was pretty good Bruce Willis prosthetics.
Oh no!
Fair.
I love that movie. I actually do. But it seems very, very similar in that way. It sounds to me like they should have. I mean, I don't mean to. It's the pick of the week. I don't mean to criticize it, but it sounds to me like the thing about other people not knowing about it and understanding the world of the present should have been presented earlier, because it would have given stuff more context. Because everything else was crazy and running around, and I think that if there was some basis for us to sort of have an understanding of the world, that might have helped earlier.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a lot happening with, like, time refugees and people being, like, basically indentured servants because they time traveled to a different era to escape something from their past. And, like, I feel like issue one did a really good job where the main character's best friend, like, disappears for a minute and then comes back as an old man and has lived this life. And, like, mm-hmm. there needs to be more, like, big idea time travel stuff like that. And yeah. So that was where I thought the hook for this issue of just like this criminal organization will find your kids in their main timeline and bring them back to the past to threaten you. That's like, and it's not, you know, and it's clear from reading this issue that like this guy's experience, this FBI agent, he's not the only person they've done this to. Like the similar mm-hmm. thing happened to his boss, and that's why his boss has also backed off of the organization. So, you know, ideas like that, fleshing out the world and the way things work, you know, it I think it helped a lot with this issue.
When it comes to time travel stuff or, you know, relativity stuff or whatever it is, I think that it really, the details, the minutiae, the stuff that you can get into are super interesting, but you have to set the table really well. And, you know, the fact is, if the idea is that the criminals are the only people who know about time travel and are doing it, or whoever, you know, what, like, and the rest of the world doesn't, that to me feels like a foundational thing.
Yeah.
It's a fun surprise, but it's not 11 issues later into an indie series that takes two years to get their surprise, if that makes sense.
I agree. I think this easily could have been, this could have been dealt with earlier as soon as the FBI agent disappeared. So I don't know what their big plan is, but I also just think that, you know, Declan Shalvey is an artist whose art I've always really enjoyed. And so, you know, much like Scotty Young, it's been interesting to watch him take a turn as a writer. And I think he's actually growing and maturing into a pretty competent one. So
sure. I mean, I think the ideas of this are all great. It's the execution to me is just like, we have all these ideas and they don't, you know, and there's not an editor necessarily to put it all together. Like, the thinking is great. The characters are good. The dialogue is good. Just needs a little something. Like, it's this like fire hose of ideas, basically. And you need to control that.
Well, I thought that this issue being like tighter and sticking on one character the whole time did that. And I think it actually does have, I think Heather Antos is editing this. So I don't want to take away from the editorial.
Editing means a lot of different things.
Sure. I'm just, comics. I just want to make sure that we weren't acting like this book didn't have an editor, but you know, in a week of solid, strong books that and connected themes, this one stood out enough that it stuck with me enough to be the pick of the week.
That's cool. I'm glad to see that. I was surprised, but I like the thinking behind the book and that you stuck with it and got something out of it. And just for the record, I don't think anybody is editing books anymore. Even the professional people at Marvel and DC don't seem to be. I people just keep trains running and put teams together and then let them run. So that's just my own issue.
So, and Superman, Son of Kal-El 11 was the opposite side of the coin here?
Yes, it was. I would say this was, you know, the, I think last time I was on the show was also an issue of this book, and it was also my runner up for pick of the week. But the conversation that happened, so in this issue, still being written by Tom Taylor with art by Cian Tormi and color by Federico Blee and Matt Herms, letters by Dave Sharp. Batman has told John that he can't trust his new boyfriend because his new boyfriend is, in addition to being affiliated with a secret news organization, is also affiliated with a secret militant group. And I thought there was a few too many secret groups that this guy is affiliated with for me to keep track of, but that's neither here nor there, because the standout moment for this issue, I thought, was the conversation between Bruce and Pa Kent.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I assume you're both still reading this, and I assume you both... No? You dropped?
No, this is the one I dropped off, yeah.
Oh, man, I think you would have really liked this scene, Connor. So the Kents are hiding out in some sort of mountain house because, you know, Clark exposed his identity, so the farm was no longer safe, and God, Batman is so being much. Very stern with John that he can't trust his new boyfriend, and John is frustrated by that, and so then Pa hands Clark a mug of coffee or a mug of tea or some sort of hot drink, and they stand on the balcony and talk about how, yeah, you know, Alfred used to worry a lot about you whenever Martha and I would have our weekly phone call with him. When we find out, which to my knowledge wasn't canon before, that there's a weekly phone chat between Alfred and Pa and Ma Kent where they just talk about their sons, and it was great. I ate that whole scene up with a spoon.
Yeah, it was pretty delightful. I like this series for the most part. I mean, and I think the way that, I mean, Tom Taylor's really good at the relationships, and so the relationship part of, like, all these unknown interconnected threads, interpersonal connected threads between sort of these characters that you've known for a long time is really interesting, and it comes across as pretty genuine. I am positive that those calls were not a thing that existed anywhere else at any time, nor will they ever be mentioned again. But when they put it here, you know, like, it's believable, and you kind of buy it. You know, it's that... I think it's, I don't even know if it's in this book, but it's come up a couple of times in different books. Like, you're keeping tabs on me? Yes, I'm always watching you. Which, by the way, is a Tom Taylor thing. So he's clearly surveilling his family. just want to go ahead and point that out. You know, and I like, I you know, I as a story, as a standalone, I don't really, you know, if we've this is what we have, this story of a young Superman trying to understand the best thing to do without the context of his father, who was making it up as he was going along. It's a different story, but it's an interesting story. If this was an Elseworld story, I would eat the whole thing up completely and not even give it a second thought.
And I like how Tom keeps developing and deepening the relationship between Dick and John, because like they are the mm-hmm. sons of the Titans, you know?
Sure.
And I like that, you know, as Clark kind of helped guide Nightwing out from under the shadow of the Bat, you know, Nightwing is now sort of serving that same role for John now that Clark is not around. And I like that, you know, we're continuing Tom Taylor's run of just writing this effortlessly confident Nightwing in a way that's not annoying. We're like, Nightwing's right. dealing with something, and like there's arsonists and there's a fire, and John's like, okay, well, you want to handle it, or do you care if I help? And he's like, yeah, I don't care if Superman comes and helps me, like I can handle this myself, or if Superman wants to come and blow out the fire for me, fine, like it's all good, I got this either way. And they just have such an easy, casual brotherly relationship that I find really endearing as well.
But here's the problem. I don't care about this Gamora story one bit.
Yeah.
I don't really care about John's relationship with his new boyfriend. All of these are machinations for us to have these little cool interpersonal conversations, and they're the thing that I take away from it.
Yep.
Every time they go back to whatever Henry Bendix, who is fucking yeah. Wildstorm character, and Gamora, which is, you know, it's an authority story, I go, oh, right, this is going on. And I don't care. I just want to get to the other bits. And it's almost like if this story, like if they just had a bunch of unconnected adventures that gave him the reason to do this, I think it would be even better. But it's comic books, and you have to put a big sort of world-ending threat behind it all the time, and there's a thread that goes between it. But like, I literally don't remember. Every time it shows up in one of these issues, I'm like, all right, that's a thing. Because I don't care. And I don't really understand or care about the boyfriend's organization, the Truth.
Either of them, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a mixed bag, you know? It's like the Red Hot Chili Peppers. The band is great, but Anthony Kiedis needs to not make more sounds. I'm going to get letters, and I don't want them. So I don't care about your opinion on that band. It was a belabored metaphor, so there we are.
I think if I had to pick, it might have been 8 Billion Genies, number one, from Image Comics, Charles Soule, Ryan Brown, and Crank. Did you guys both read this?
I did.
Yes.
It felt like the setup to an interesting Twilight Zone story. It's an 8-issue miniseries in which there's a bunch of people in a band in St. Clair Shores, Michigan. It's a out of the way bar, and there's a rock band that's unloading. They're going to play a gig, but no one's really there to see it. They don't really have any fans. There's a couple other people in the bar. And then all of a sudden, a bunch of genies pop up because there's a genie for every human on the planet, and everyone gets one wish.
But also, the bar is called the Lampwick. Get it?
Oh, yeah.
Genies, lamps.
Didn't until yeah. now.
And so chaos ensues because everyone gets to have the one wish, and chaos outside the bar ensues. But the bartender very astutely, and there's clearly something else going on with this bartender, very quickly makes a wish saying none of the wishes outside of this bar will affect anyone inside the bar. And so they're almost like in this safe house bunker as the world goes to chaos outside. I just thought this was incredibly fun and thoughtful. And not at all without what I was expecting when I saw the title, and that was Charles Soule.
I had no idea what to expect, and Charles Soule has done things in the past that I found really interesting, and then he's done things more recently. You know, he makes his living by doing Star Wars comics that I don't really read, but I do remember in the past he's done a hell of a lot of really interesting books and thematically interesting. Like, you couldn't pick out his books really and say, like, oh, this is a classic Charles Soule story, because he defies that to a certain extent.
I actually think there is a thematic connection with a lot of his previous work. I think one of the thematic connections that Charles Soule likes exploring is cascading unintended consequences.
I'll give you that.
He had that book that was like the math book in New York, where it was like, mm-hmm. you've got to, you know, knock this paper cup off the subway platform to make sure nobody dies, sort of thing.
Yeah, you're right. But they're sort of big ideas, and then he's got to stick a framework of characters inside. And by the way, when you just said it's 8 issues, I thought, good. This does not need to I thought 8's too long.
Eight might be too many, but yeah.
But, you know, better than 30. And whatever the last book that he did with Ryan Brownwell was, The Wizards, you know, I lasted about 8, you know, and then I sort of, you know, gave up on the thing. Again, huge, really great big ideas. This one's so wacky. And then that device of nothing affects anything inside the bar, I was like, that bartender is the smartest person on earth to be able to do that kind of planning that quickly. And, you know, fine.
Well, there's clearly something else going on because he speaks Mandarin, like, he's clearly on a different plane than everyone else in this little out of the way.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be going to be the genie.
Yeah.
Was what I thought at first, just because he seemed to be, he seemed to have something, you know, he said, I've been around a really long time or something like that. So
I liked that there was no time wasted. She's like, everyone's got genies. What is it? No, we're not going to talk about it. You got genies. Move along. You get one wish.
And I was like, oh, and I thought the device of showing the Earth at the first 8 seconds and you can see all the blue flashes as the genies come online and you have the human population and the genie population. They're both at 8 billion. And then the first 8 minutes, Earth is already a cube. There are multiple explosions happening and the genie population is only down by like 2 million. So, you know, within the first 2 million wishes, the Earth is already a cube and everything's on fire.
Well, yeah, and 1 million people are dead.
Yeah.
Because they're down to 7,999,000,000. So
I hope they keep that going throughout the series. I want to keep seeing how the Earth morphs and changes as the populations dwindle or maybe not dwindle.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, one of the band members, she's in love with the lead singer. So her wish is that he'll be in love with her. But he was inside the bar when she made the wish. She was outside the bar. So it doesn't work. And he gets all mad at her because she tried to basically love potion him. Like there's a lot of interesting things happening and very quickly in this. And, you know, the funny bits outside where we keep looking outside the bar and seeing, you know, like a T-Rex running down the street, eating people and a giant dude and a UFO, like, you know, dude in a mech suit or guys in a big fucking monster truck full of, is that gold? Yeah. So like, you know, people are stupid and this is exactly what would happen.
And Ryan Brown's a good artist for that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, I think Charles Soule has the dynamism as a writer and storyteller to be able to do a lot of things like that, and I think Ryan Brown, given his sort of, what's the word, I was gonna say wacky, but that's not really it, his inventive and sort of funny and, you know, style really complements that, and that sort of brings that part out. I love the sort of space between turning the Earth into a cube and the bass player in the band has a crush on the singer or whatever they are, you know. Like, and right away you're going, oh, these are children. That's the worst wish you could ever make. Like, it's such a bad idea to be like, I wish he loved me. And I was like, have you never seen any stories? But kids are dumb, you know? And also, you know, he starts off with this bar band. Charles used to play in bar bands. Like, that was a thing. I've been to see his bar band once. You know, and so we, you know, writers keep going back to those things, those themes that they really love.
But so, also think of, if you think about it, literal children also have genies in this book.
Yeah. That's no good.
Yeah.
That's no good. Somebody, I would have a kid downstairs with like infinite Robux. And I was like, you fucking kidding me?
or the world suddenly, your house suddenly becomes a Minecraft house.
Yeah. We're past that.
Oh yeah. Active. No.
It was just, everybody would sound like a YouTuber with their fucking clipping mics.
I thought this was fun. I wasn't expecting. I didn't know what to expect. I just saw the title and the creative team. I was like, oh, I'll give that a shot. And
same.
After I was like, oh, that was super fun. I really want to know what happens next. So that's probably what it might pick. But I didn't.
And also,
pick one, so
like nothing else.
Absolutely. What's, and look, nothing else. Image is like? Doing.
It's like nothing else I can think of. Yeah. No. Totally. It's fun.
We continue the saga of Love Everlasting. This is issue 3. I don't know when issue 3 actually came out, but this is when we got it. Tom King, Elsa, we butchered her last name last time.
Charretier, or you could say it American, Charretier, but...
Matt Hollingsworth, Clayton Cowles, and I don't even think I necessarily even care what the overarching story in this is anymore, because I just really enjoy these vignettes of love, of like crazy overwrought love stories in comics. And they're all connected in a weird way. We still haven't gotten there. We're only 3 issues in, but You could take that out. I almost wouldn't enjoy the book any less.
It's interesting that those stories are so compelling because they are overwrought and they're silly. And yet, what's the deal with a librarian? Right. You know, why would you name your kid after your long lost love who's a librarian who came back to town? And it's like I don't know if that's maybe this is why people like soap operas, where I could look at it and be like, that's so dumb. But it is compelling in some way. But it's a little bit like, why are you so stupid? You know, but also you kind of want them to succeed or be happy or whatever, you know, because you're watching this girl and she decides to stay in town with her boyfriend.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing as the one in the last book. You're like, that's terrible. You are absolutely going to regret that.
Yes.
You know, which is the difference between age and youth almost to a T. But you're right. It is really compelling. And you know, in the blueprint surface, it shouldn't be. It should be. We are all fairly advanced readers and understanding of story, and it should be dumb. But I'm like, oh, it's going to happen. Like, I'm 100% titillated by the thing.
Yeah. It's, you know, so was it like the 50s? I guess this is where it takes place.
More or less early 60s, I guess.
It's that era, that mid-century American era in which two high school seniors are in love, and she's going off to college on the coast, and he's staying in town, going to the community college. And,
I'm so sorry. This isn't meant for a person listening to it, but in terms of the story, that guy's a loser.
Yeah.
he's Al Bundy.
Right. In the same way her father peaked in college, her boyfriend is peaking right now. And she clearly is meant for better and bigger things, but he convinces her, and the librarian, who basically is her story, who also, well, she went off and saw the world, but came back an old single maid who's probably 28.
Yeah.
And if that, she may be 26.
Prototypical hot librarian.
Right. Who is still looked at as an old maid who's never going to get married because she's way too old now. Which, you know, odd makes sense because at that age, most people were married. Mm-hmm. It's not like now, you know. But convince the girl, Joan, to stay in the small town and not go to college on the coast and have a big life. And then we find out there's her father and the librarian were in love in high school. They were the same couple as she and her boyfriend were. And that's why her father's miserable and her mother's miserable. And then the very end, like last time's story, there's some connection to this overarching thing in which Joan, the librarian, is Joan, who we've seen throughout the whole series, and the boyfriend is the guy, and he tries to kill her. And that stuff, I'm interested, and I want to know what it means, but I almost don't care. Like, I'm of two minds of it. I like it, but also don't care.
I'm actually right with you. I understand exactly what you're saying.
Like, she taught me more of these crazy love stories. And if it all comes together, fine. But if not, that's also fine.
It's fine.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be fine. It'd be fine if the folks out there who said, I like this show, I like what you guys do, go over to patreon.com/ifanboy and you put your money where your mouth is, or your typing fingers, which isn't alliterative, so it doesn't sound as good. That's where you can go to support this show. Patreon.com/ifanboy. Many folks have, and we appreciate them very much. And as such, a second or third iteration of our wonderful community has bloomed again. Mm-hmm. It is a new dawn for that kind of thing, which has been great.
You can't keep it down.
You can't. We have the best people.
Like, yeah, fan base is like life; it finds a way.
There's intelligent, like thoughtful. Like, we weed out assholes like nobody's business. If it was a lawn, it would be perfect. You know, and so one of the ways you can do that, you can be part of the community, but there's patron-only Discord and Facebook groups that are flourishing and delightful. You can directly support the show. You can unlock shows for everybody else. The next stretch goal right now, we're probably going to talk about the stretch goals and what they look like going forward.
Yeah.
But it would be a comic book TV podcast.
Well, it's not a show. It's we'll start covering comic book TV shows because we haven't been covering them. So it's not like a comic book TV show podcast. It's just when the show is on, like Moon Knight, we'll cover it. But we don't do it currently. Yeah.
If for some reason you were to beat that stretch goal, we would do that. We would start that right away. But yes. we might change things around a little
bit. Which would mean I'd have to finish Moon Knight.
Oh, yeah, same.
Because I'm not finished and I have no desire to be.
That's not going to happen. The good news is you haven't missed anything. You can go to ifanboy.threadless.com. Again, I don't want your letters. You can go to ifanboy.threadless.com. You will find design. You'll find 12 designs that can go on t-shirts and items and skateboards and rugs and bath shower curtains. Mm-hmm. Our newest design is the Gosh. I have no objects with the Gosh design on it. And I need to rectify that.
Oh, you got to have at least a shirt, man.
I got a lot of shirts, dude. I have lot of shirts. I have
this
more
was your idea. You coined it.
I know. I just think I would get a different item. Oh, listen, okay, something happens, you go, I got to take care of that. And then before you know it, 7 years have gone by. And that's how time works now. Ask Declan Chalvey. So get to ifanboy.threadless.com. If you don't deal with any of that and you're like, hey, I want to put something in the virtual tip jar, then you got ifanboy.com/support. We can find a PayPal link. Then there's ifanboy.com/Amazon where you can find links to buy the books that we talk about on the Booksplodes. You will always find a link to the music and to the pick of the week on the show page. And then also just a general link if you're getting pet supplies or I got a huge bag of dog poop bags. It's just a huge package of them. I should be good for a few years. And if I had been actually if I bought that through the affiliate link, then we would have been the benefit of those dog poop bag purchases to the tune of cents. You could go to bookshop.org as well. We partner with them to help local bookstores. And you'll find the links on the site where we can fit them and they're appropriate. Let us move along to more comic books.
Did either of you read the stupidly titled Hulk versus Thor Banner of War Alpha number one?
Either that title is stupid or brilliant. I'm not willing to. I looked at it and went, Banner of War. It's kind of clever, but I kind of hate it. So I can't really fault it.
It was the alpha where they lost me.
Yeah. Well,
they'll throw that word alpha in all over Marvel for some reason.
So they're about to cross. Donny Cates writes Hulk. Donny Cates writes Thor. They're about to cross over. And so this is the kickoff issue. And at first I was annoyed, but then it's like, okay, but if you're doing that, Hulk people who aren't reading Thor might miss out. And Thor people who aren't reading Hulk might miss out. This way everyone misses out because probably hardly anybody read it. So this is just kicking off what's going to be the next story.
I bet this thing sold big gangbusters.
Oh, who knows? I don't know.
Hulk versus Thor. Cates is enormously popular with the folks who like Hulk versus Thor, and he gives them what they want.
If I saw this title in a book in a store, I would probably be like, what is happening?
These are the Venom people. And right. I bought it. I read it. I'm there. You know, I was like, all right, impress me.
I like this. I don't know what's happening in Hulk. I still don't know what's happening. I mean, I know what's happening. We talked about this last time with the Hulk issue.
Yeah.
It's not been working for me, but Thor has been. And so this was fun. And I look forward to the crossover.
I think I enjoyed it as much as I've enjoyed any of the Hulk issues. Mm. Which is to say, there's some energy about this. There's some relentless forward motion about this. But I don't know. I don't even know what the stakes are.
Yeah, that's a good point. I liked Uatu with a bowl of popcorn. I thought this was a beautiful looking book.
From Martin Coccolo.
Yeah.
Yes.
According to Watcher Rules, is enjoying what you're watching with a bowl of popcorn, is that okay?
I think it's okay. As long as he's just watching.
Yeah.
So you're allowed to like relish your job as a wife. Oh, this is good.
I think so.
I hope.
Okay. Okay.
Although I wonder if he's got butter in that popcorn because look at those gloves. I mean,
it looked pretty dry to me.
Those gloves are not going to do well with that butter.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's got space coat.
Josh, you're a popcorn movie guy. Do you get butter on your popcorn?
Fuck yeah. Although, you know, you can it would be some sort of alchemy to be able to get it past the top layer. So I have a system is that I get a big popcorn and then I get one of those little drink things, the little bowl, and I pour some of that in
the tray.
The
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's how I divide it up. So that way I have more room to work with on the shake. But yeah, sure. No, the popcorn is the butter's great, but you have to like you could kill yourself. So you really want to be careful. I'm killing myself.
I'm just saying, the last time I was on a movie and my hands were just covered in butter.
Oh, sure.
Like, this is not comfortable.
And probably before the previews even started, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Well, yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and try not to eat the popcorn before the movie starts. Good luck with that. No, I got a jacket this winter. And it was for skiing. It was a mid-layer. It was a nice jacket. And I went to the movies on my birthday, and I hit the pump, and it bounced off something and just splattered right on the sleeve of the jacket. And I was like, well, that's never coming out. Like, I had moments of this, like, really high-end Patagonia technical wear, just... Oh, well. And Lindsay knows that, like, one of my great irritations is I cook and I get grease spots on my clothes all the time, and it drives me crazy.
You don't have an apron?
I do, but, you know, I don't use it, I guess.
You gotta slap on that apron.
I guess. But either way, like,
I'm gonna buy you a chef's jacket for Christmas.
I'm constantly, like, stopping what I'm doing and going in with, like, dish soap and baking powder, baking soda to try to get out grease stains that I've accidentally put in a new piece of clothing I got.
Yeah, dish soap works pretty well.
It does. Anyway, it's only if you get it right away.
This was fun. Thor and Hulk are fighting on some planet where they bet on fighting.
The conversation before the show is, in that second group of books, we really got to plow through.
I know.
It. And Connor, you started that.
I was just curious about the popcorn. You know, I'm looking forward to this. It's going to be a short crossover. It's just two issues per.
That's fine.
Per book. So I'm looking forward to it.
Grimm. From Boom Studios, written by Stephanie Phillips, and art by Flaviano, with color by Rico Renzi, whose name I seem to recognize from Rick Remender books, I think. This is basically a Grim Reaper story. It is not dissimilar to Carmen. There is a cute, short-haired Grim Reaper girl, and you sort of see there is a back, you know, you see the back room to the Grim Reaper people who send souls into the afterlife. If I hadn't read Carmen before, I think I would have thought this was really good. Not really good, but interesting enough to keep going. I thought the art was fantastic, but it was so similar in a way. It didn't have the girl, you know, the dead person in this,
right?
Isn't as interesting as the dead person in the other one.
Is the cute short haired version of death Neil Gaiman's fault?
It has to
I mean,
be.
It's got to be, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's
not his fault. It's just everybody else ripping him off.
So in this one, like, so for some reason, the people who are the Grim Reapers who harvest the souls and bring them in, they're it's like they're working off some sort of debt or something like that. And she loses her scythe and finds out that the guy that she was taking it. So he goes back to get his wife back or something like this. He was drunk driving and hit a tree.
I found the guy very annoying. In a way, like, yeah. He was not a compelling character, and I don't really want him to win.
I think Stephanie Phillips still creates great worlds, and she writes great dialogue and sort of creates characters. And again, like, she seems to be able to do any kind of story.
I really love that every book of hers, the next book is totally different.
Yep.
100%. It's totally different. Yeah. This is totally different than the 1930s crime Jewish mobsters book she just did, and different than the pirate book before that. Like, totally different books.
Yep,
that's great.
Yeah, she's reached a status where if I see a number one from her, I'll definitely check it out, because
100%.
She's earned that.
I think this week I decided that Batman Urban Legends, this issue 15 came out, is my favorite Batman book, and that's not Bat Family because that'd be Nightwing, obviously, but Batman book, which is a testament to the book's strength, but also testament to the weakness of the Batman books overall currently. But this is an anthology book, so there's lots of things going on, and this just has a lot of great stories right now. There's the Batman Zatanna story that I'm really enjoying. We're at issue 5 and 6 of that. I don't really want that to end because I really like that romance. There was a really fun one-shot Batman Plastic Man team up drawn by Jason Howard that I really liked. And I skipped the Birds of Prey story because I don't know who any of those characters are other than Katana. And then there's been a really good Mark Russell story going through this. We're also part 5 or 6 of that, in which it's about the pets. So Ace the Bat Hound is the sort of the main character here. And that's been a really great, really fun Mark Russell, which has been sort of flying under, I think, most people's radars. But I've been really enjoying this anthology. Anthologies don't usually work. Anthologies don't really usually last that long, but this one's been going pretty strong, and I think it's a really quality book.
I keep looking at it and remembering that I really liked the Zdarsky Jason Todd story, and I really liked the Matt Rosenberg.
Yeah, there's been great stories throughout.
Grifter story, but I'm also like,
feel like I got to dig through it to get to the good part, and I don't want to read most
of it. Three out of four of these stories were good, and I think that's been the case usually. Like, there was the Tim Drake story through some of it. Like, it's always been at least half. There's usually four stories, at least half the stories, but usually three out of four are good.
Shang-Chi number 12. This is wrapping up the second arc that Gene Yuan Yang has done. I've been sticking with the series. I liked the first arc where he was kind of fighting different heroes of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, that was the best part.
This second arc is sort of him wrapping up the situation with all of his siblings, but also them incorporating the MCU version of the Ten Rings as opposed to the Iron Man Mandarin style. So now they've got those style of Ten Rings in the MCU, and they're that same sort of corrupting influence from the movie. So Shang-Chi has to like overcome it with his, you know, iron will and inherent goodness. And the issue kind of ends with the gang splitting up. And so all the siblings that I was finally starting to get a handle on all go their separate ways. And now Shang-Chi is just on his own. He's got access to the Ten Rings, and I truly do not know what's going to happen next. And it sounds like this was the end of this series, and they're rebooting it with Shang-Chi and the Ten Rings, number one. Hopefully still being written. If it's still being written by Gene Luen Yang, I'll check it out, because I think he's doing a good job with this character, and it's the most fleshed out version of this character I've read in comics up to this point. So I will stick with it if Gene Luen Yang is the guy doing it.
I like it, but I don't love it. He's got a... Yang has a voice that is fairly consistent through his books that I like. It's different than the other ones. But I find my grasp on this to be tenuous, other than wanting to know what he's going to do. And I'm totally putting this down to the writer. I kind of want to know what he's going to do. I just want to see his thinking. I want to see his process work out. That's why I read his books, even the ones I don't love.
Yeah, I liked the first six issues of this volume. I think it's funny that every so often it reboots. So this would be like the fourth time. The first Shang-Chi volume, they rebooted it. There was a one-shot, and then it was this series, and now it's going to be Shang-Chi and the Ten Rings. It's like this will be like the fourth volume in the last 2 years of this book.
I feel like there's a philosophy at Marvel that if there was a movie, then we can definitely support a comic book series. And as we all know, as readers, there's no way that's true. Right. If it's not, Captain America. And I feel like every time they reboot it, it's this little bit of optimism. Like, well, maybe if we change the title and give it another one, we can make it work. Because I can't imagine the numbers will support this. I mean, 12 issues is kind of amazing for a Shang-Chi book. That's movie or no, because as we know, those don't really affect comic sales other than a quick blip. Yeah, but that sort of rebooting and renaming, I think, can only be like they really want to make it work. So and that's all they have. Like, let's make it number one. And
I like the beginning of this where every issue was a team up with a different character who was a star of a Marvel movie. It was incredibly cynical, but I enjoyed the stories. And then when those characters left, I've been less interested in this. Like you, Ryan, like I don't really have a handle on the siblings, and it seems like it's been the same story in some variation over and over and over again. It's like he's fighting against the shadow of his father, and then some evil person from his past shows up and tries to kill him, and then they don't, and then...
How different is this from Thor right now? The answer is none. He's got his weapon, his dad talks to him and calls him an asshole while he does it. It's exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Are you guys all sticking with the new volume if Gene Luen Yang's writing it?
Yeah, yes. that was my caveat. But yes.
I guess I'll check it out. I don't know. I had the drop off of Monkey Prince. I just couldn't do it anymore. And
Connor, he's a genius. Gene Luen Yang is a genius.
He's written some of my absolute favorite comics of the last decade, bar none. But sometimes it doesn't work. I didn't think Monkey Prince is working at all. Shang-Chi, I've enjoyed probably 50% of the issues. So it's worth giving it one more shot. But I don't know that it's overly compelling right now.
I think, I mean, you're right. Like, I love his work that I love, and it's clear there. But, I'm not going to tell you I'm not biased by the fact, like, he's one of the nicest, most enthusiastic, genuinely... nice people who I've ever talked to, in terms of people who make comics. And I just am like, all right, I'm on the team. Let's do this.
Well, there's a reason why I'm still reading this, and the reason why I went three issues on Monkey Prince further than I liked it. Like, I want it to be good because he's talented and super nice, but I haven't. I read every issue of these Shang-Chi books.
Yeah.
All of them.
Me too.
And I've enjoyed a good portion of them, but I just don't love it. But I'll check out the next one because they, whatever, they're rebooted. Let's see what happens now. But I'm not going to, I don't know. I've read them all. So those are the books we want to talk about, but at patreon.com/ifanboy, those patrons that Josh mentioned earlier, every one of them can vote to add a book to the rundown. And this week, in super overwhelming fashion, the winner was The Jurassic League number one from DC Comics, written by Juan Gedeon and Daniel Warren Johnson, with art by Juan Gedeon and Mike Spicer on colors, Ferran Delgado on letters. And I had to recalibrate while reading this. I started reading it and I was like, well, wait a minute. There's people here. And then, wait a minute. Are some of these dinosaurs humanoid and some aren't? And then I was like, you know what? Stop thinking about it. Just stop worrying about it. It's not going to make any sense. So I had to sort of switch my brain to being like, okay, trying to make it make like logical sense. Like, oh, does this ship's arrival cause some of these dinosaurs to become humanoid? Nope, they were already humanoid before. And there's a whole humanoid race of dinosaurs on Themyscira. Just don't worry about it. That's what I had to do while reading this book. Actually, I'm sure Ryan had even a harder time with.
I had to turn off my brain from the start and keep it off the entire time. I mean, you know, obviously humans and dinosaurs did not coexist, at least in the Mesozoic. I mean, the idea of a Batman or a bat dinosaur doesn't make sense because bats didn't exist.
Yeah,
there were no dolphins.
The show's almost over. No, it's not interesting. No, it's just.
So, I'm sorry.
So yeah, it assumes a world where everything. I mean, you know, I've gotten used to the fact that dinosaur books will get the timing of different periods of dinosaurs existing completely wrong. So if you ever see a stegosaurus next to a T-Rex, like, that doesn't make sense. We're actually closer in time to when T-Rex existed than T-Rex was to when stegosaurs existed. Just to put that in perspective. But, you know, I've gotten over that because I feel like people just think all dinosaurs existed all at once.
There's also the maxim that you need to keep in mind. Life finds a way.
Life does find a way.
It means what I'm saying. You know what's interesting is that, like, I know what you're talking about, and I have been reading about it my entire life, and I cannot keep the eras straight, and nor which dinosaurs were in it, and I think I just was like, eh, dinosaurs. Like, I know that if I look into it for even a half a second, what you're saying is I know it's absolutely true, but I just have never been able to keep it straight. And I was a kid, like, who was interested in dinosaurs, and I was like, well, it's Cretaceous, Jurassic, Mesozoic, eh. Like, now, I realize, cannot remember it.
I realize we're talking about this in a book in which dinosaurs are all speaking English and fighting in costumes. So there's a lot of things you've got to sort of let go. But it was more of like the basic like idea of the world. Like, what is the foundation? Is the foundation of this world this was dinosaurs and then something happened to make them heroes? Or I guess were there always humanoid, meaning dinosaurs with legs and human arms? And like, I just at a certain point, I was like, you know what? You got to stop. Just fuck it. Like, read the book. And it was fine. I think the thing that was most disappointing was I was very excited when it was reported that Danny Warren Johnson was doing this book, but he's kind of doing this book. He's co-writing it. He's not drawing it. And the art, while fine, was like so much less dynamic than if he had drawn it.
Yet fully in his style.
Yes, it was totally in his style. It just, you could see the difference. A lot of it was just very straight on shots of things. There were some good panels and some dynamic stuff, but mostly it was just like a lot of medium straight shots. And it's like, this is what Daniel Warren Johnson's art would look like if it wasn't incredibly dynamic and full of flair and energy. And it's not bad. It just was like, I kept picturing what this book would have been like.
I think it says everything that I was much more interested in the conversation that we were just having about dinosaurs than I was like, thank God we're talking about this, because I don't know what to say about the book, because I just didn't care at all.
Yeah, I feel like it's not definitely not a book for you, for sure.
No. I mean, like, I get what it is, and I get why it'd be exciting, but really, you know, we were talking about this in terms of Elseworld stories. You know, if they bring something to the table, because in the context of Knights of Steel, you know, that they're telling a different version of the superhero mm-hmm. origin stories or whatever. And sometimes they do something that's different. And sometimes they just dress up the characters in the clothing of a different thing and make the connections, you know, and so they come up with a clever name, you know, that is dinosaur based. And that's kind of it. And that's what this was. This was, you know, this was an art project. It was just like, hey, let's draw this cool big shit. And I have no problem with it, but I don't care about it. Is kind of where I was at. Like there wasn't a narrative I could.
It wasn't. It was a bunch of. It was a bunch of short bits. We met Batman for a long time. He was fighting a Joker, Sor, and then we a couple pages with Aquaman, dinosaur, a couple pages with Wonder Woman, Superman.
Joker Sor, not a good name.
Whatever his name was, I don't know.
They're I know just, whatever it was. I thought, come on, we could do better than that.
I thought there'd be some sort of big because it opens up with the ship crashing on Earth and the primitive man version of Ma and Pa Kent finding it with a little dinosaur humanoid hand in it. I thought, well, maybe that's going to cause ripples throughout the world and change things. But it didn't. It was just a humanoid dinosaur. There's already dinosaurs.
It was wrestling introductions.
Yeah. Ryan, what did you think of this?
I did really like how self-serious all of the Tri-Mascara stuff was. I thought that was actually kind of funny. I don't know why you would name Wonder Dawn. Like, Triceratops doesn't have Dawn in it. Like, it's not a clever play on words. I was a little confused by that. But on the whole, yeah, I didn't quite see how this all was supposed to come together in a way that... you're right. It didn't, as a story, it didn't coalesce in quite the way I was expecting it or hoping it would.
Yeah, it's weird. It could look... I'm not above having fun, and this could have been super fun. It just didn't feel fun. You know, it felt like we have some dinosaur superhero drawings, and we're just going to have them fight other dinosaurs. Like, it didn't really grab me in any way in terms of, wow, that was really fun and inventive, and it just was like, you know, it just was.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's exactly it. Like, there was, you know... If you were really into it because you thought the art was fun and it was like interpreting these folks as dinosaurs and having a big dinosaur fight, and that's what you're into. And I am not surprised that that is the thing that Daniel Warren Johnson would be into.
Okay,
that works, you know, and there's folks for it, but it wasn't enough for me. And it wasn't even, didn't even.
There was one point where Batmanosaur, I don't know what his name was, but I'm just going to do that for everyone.
Yeah,
did like a suplex move on Joker Sor. That was a very wrestling move, and I was like, "Yep, there we go. That's why they're doing this book." Yeah, which is fine. I just wish it was more dynamic. I wish it was more. Is what I'm saying.
I mean, like, it'd be one thing if it was, you know, Daniel Warren Johnson doing the art, but it wasn't. So, mm-hmm. you know, what do you have then? Need some narrative, folks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ratings.
Ratings. Out of 5. 2.75.
Yeah, same.
I think I could go to 3, but I think I'll keep it. I'll keep us all in the hand-holding club, and I'll also say 2.75.
Was it Joker-zard?
Joker's. It was. It was hard to. I tried saying it out loud, and it didn't.
Joker-zard.
Joker-zard.
Isn't that a Power Rangers thing?
It seemed. It felt very Power Ranger-y.
Your age, so that makes sense.
Hey, Ryan, did you read Justice League and Legion of Superheroes this week?
I did.
Was I crazy? Were those feathered dinosaurs in that book?
It was good. It was good feathers.
Yeah, I was like, oh, hey, look, someone's actually trying.
Yeah, I appreciated that.
All right, so patreon.com/ifanboy. If you are a patron, all patrons can vote to add a book to the rundown, but if you give it the $5 or a higher level, you get a superpower live on the show. Let's do it.
That would be me. Joe Bowen has the power to immolate people who pun or use wordplay.
Immolate them. He immolates them.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, shit.
So, you know, it's not... I went back and... I didn't say that. I mean, in some circles. I'm just saying.
You just committed pal Paul to death.
You know what? Unless he can show some self-control... Can you tell me he doesn't deserve it? I'm saying I can't remember what was happening when I wrote this one down, but I just thought that person should be burned to death. So if you ignore, you have the urge, you say, oh, I thought of this pun, but it's really bad if I say it out loud because it's just going to be terrible and everybody in the room is going to go, ugh. You have to think doubly about it because you could be immolated. Oh, are they?
Oh, boy. All right. Al Folger is the ball man. He can produce any kind of ball that is needed moment. Baseballs, basketballs, footballs, soccer balls, cricket balls, any kind of ball, squeeze, stress ball, Nerf ball, gym class.
Run his own Powerball lottery?
He could have his own Powerball lottery. Yeah, yeah. Ping pong balls.
Bingo balls.
Meatballs.
Meatballs.
Pizza balls.
So wait. They do not necessarily have to be spherical then. They have to be identifiable as a ball.
Yeah.
Can he I apologize. Can he generate testicles?
I was thinking there's that old Mayan game that is like the predecessor to soccer that they supposedly sometimes played with human heads. Does that mean he can then generate human heads because they were used as a ball?
They were used as a ball is one thing, an actual ball is a different thing.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, like people, you know, in South American countries and Central American countries, they use rocks to play baseball. It doesn't mean a rock is a ball. You know.
What about like, I mean, yeah, okay. Bocce balls?
Bocce balls, sure. Volleyballs. Absolutely.
Wow.
Pinball balls. Any kind of ball, he can generate it.
Pinball ball is elusive because it's the one ball you use when you're playing pinball, but I've never held one, so I don't know what it would actually feel like to have one in my hand.
What about marbles? Because no one calls marbles balls. But they're not. But they're no one calls them balls. Okay.
But they are.
Those are balls.
What about cheese
Wait,
ball?
So wait, I'm sorry. One more question.
Yeah.
Say the pinball thing. He wants to make a pinball show up. Does it show up in his hand, or can he have it show up in the machine?
If he tries really hard, if he concentrates hard, he can make it show up in the machine. So therefore, he could be a pinball cheat.
He's a pinball wizard.
He could be pinball wizard. Ball wizard is his name.
I could have been immolated for that. That was close enough.
See, you gave Joe.
I could have not done that.
A terrible and scary power, and now it's come back to bite you.
It's true. I could have not used lyrics from an old song and raised my eyebrows that neither of you could see for one of you to recognize that I said it, because we were doing the wordplay about pinball, but I didn't, and I would have. Can you tell me that I wouldn't have deserved to be immolated just then?
Yeah, I don't think it's a immolatable offense, but that's your thing.
Immolatable. I don't think that's an immolatable offense, which, you know, practically and literally speaking, totally true. But figuratively.
Oh, boy.
Maybe he doesn't immolate them. Everybody just sees them get immolated and gives everybody a start. But you're not actually dead or burned.
Brian Stenberg can change people's astrological signs.
Oh, so like their date of birth?
If you're in a conversation with somebody and they're like, well, I was responding this way because I'm a Taurus and they're a Leo. You're like, no, you're not. None of that means anything. I actually changed you. You're now a Gemini.
I'm going to go ahead and add that to the immolation. If anybody mentions their sign and gives it any meaning whatsoever.
I know, but Brian can now punk all of them because he can just change it. And like if an astronomer went back in time to the day of that person's birth and looked in the sky, it would be a different constellation. It wouldn't be the constellation they thought. It would actually change it in time so that they are now officially an Aries.
Are those constant?
There's drift.
So if you're a Pisces, right.
Yeah, there is drift, but it's over much longer time scales than the average human lifespan. So, like, eventually the North Star will not be the North Star anymore, but it's going to be tens of thousands of years from now.
Okay.
All right. Patreon.com/iFanboy. If you give it the $5 or higher level, you can get your own superpower live on the show. Now, I know we're long, but 2 weeks ago we were recording the show, and then shortly after recording it, we got the word that Neil Adams passed away. We meant to talk about it last week, but we had so many technical problems, we ended up not doing it. And then left the last week's show. Shortly thereafter, we got the word that George Perez passed away, which is, you know, unfortunately news we had all been waiting for. Not waiting for, but, you know, braced for. But it was a rough 1-2 punch to lose two legitimate legends of comic book, the world of comic books in the span of 14 days. And we talked about this on the Booksplode that all three of us were on, the Contract with God show. But, you know, we're going to start. We've already lost most of the, if not all of the Golden Age and or Silver Age legends of comics, although Neil Adams crosses over into the Silver Age. We're going to start losing, you know, not just in comics, but in all of our lives, our artistic heroes. We're at that age where that's going to start happening. But really, the comic book industry has been around for such a short period of time that it almost felt like at a certain point, everyone was still with us. And now it's going to be different now. And it's sad because those guys are genuine, you know, huge. And Perez was young, relatively.
How old was he?
He was in the late, I think he was 67. I believe he was 67. Yeah, he was 67, and Neil Adams was 80, which feels young, too.
It's just too young. Yeah. And he's, you know, because he's been doing work. He's been doing more work than Perez. I mean, like, he's...
Yeah,
like,
well, yeah, he's been able to.
Up until a couple of years ago, you saw his work pretty damn regularly. And it's interesting because, you know, you said that when you say two legends, sometimes when two people... die or have stories about them within close proximity of each other, you sort of have to lump the one and then the other who is lesser. But really, these are two titans of equal stature, you know, for different reasons or whatever. But like in their time, in their prime, they were the alpha artist.
Right.
I mean, like they were. Like Neil Adams changed the game. He is a bridge between, you know, the Silver Age and the Bronze Age, and George Perez kind of also in a slightly different way. But like if you had, you know, in the 80s, George Perez on a superhero comic meant that it was a bestseller. Neil Adams on a superhero comic in the 70s and 60s meant that it was a bestseller and earned, I mean, fully, you know, by just being an instantly recognizable artistic creative force, right on site. I mean, like any of us could tell their art from a thousand paces, and then have countless imitators. I mean, these are the guys, you know, who people try to draw like, and no one quite does it.
Yeah, I was thinking about this after Perez died. I mean, Neil Adams is almost like, I mean, not just an artistic giant, but, you know, he tried to change the industry. He tried to, he fought for artist rights. He fought to make sure artists got their pages back from the company instead of them just getting burned. You know, like there's all kinds of things the industry doesn't look like if he hasn't come around. All those art dealers and convention sales are not happening if Neil Adams doesn't happen. But Neil Adams was almost, when I was a kid, he was almost someone from the past, even though he was working. It was like, he was a name I knew, and I read his stories in like compilations, but he wasn't someone who I was actively reading as a kid. And I was thinking, who are the artists that inform my tastes in art? And I came down to three names from, and they're all from my childhood. So like Kevin Maguire, George Perez, and John Byrne, because when I came on in the '80s, Perez and Byrne were the two biggest guys working, and Maguire was one of the first comics I remember reading as a kid and really sparking to that style. But, you know, Perez worked on every major character, every major book in both Marvel and DC. He did a legendary run on the Justice League. He did a legendary run on the Avengers, and then he did it again. He did Crisis on Infinite Earths. He did the New Teen Titans. He, you know, it was like, if there was a big book in the 80s and 90s, early 90s, Perez was probably on it. And it just informed my taste going forward. I was someone who liked all those Image guys. I liked Jim Lee. I liked McFarlane. I liked Liefeld. But if you, like, my number one guy was Perez and Byrne. Those were two number one guys, and more, my friends were all about Jim Lee and Liefeld. I remember I had there was a Infinity Gauntlet promotional thing they gave out that was about the size of a Trapper Keeper notebook. And it, those notebooks had the little sleeve you could slide it guard into. And I had that in my high school notebook. Like it was the image of, it was a promotional image from Infinity Gauntlet that George Perez did. Cause that just was the style I love. I still remember the first time I read Infinity Gauntlet number one. I remember just marveling at the art. I have a very distinct memory of reading that first issue. So Perez is like a, you know, Neil Adams he goes on the Mount Rushmore of comic book artists. And Perez for me is one of my all-time favorites, all-time greats.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a bummer. It's also Perez. I can't think of another person who he was like, I'm sick.
Yeah.
And then he kept talking to people, you know, through the course of being sick, and you know, was always so upbeat. And there's no reason to fake it if you're going to. So I tend to feel I'm hoping that that's like a genuine thing for him.
Everyone you talk to says he was the nicest guy in comics. And
if you see him if you've ever seen him on a convention floor, he was always smiley. Like he was a guy that you kind of want. And I never did talk to him, but
why didn't we ever interview him? I don't know. Were we scared?
Maybe. I think there were certain people there were certain people that we grew up with who we admired so much that we just didn't feel qualified to have a conversation with them that wasn't a waste of their time. That was what that's kind of how I guess I approached
it. Ironically, we did interview Neil Adams.
Well, he became a bit of a punchline for one thing that he did at one point, and I think that we fell victim to that for a certain time. There's certain guys like they're legends, and then as they pass a little bit out of favor, they'll do something. And he had this book that he did about the world expanding. Was it universe or the earth?
It was the world. It was, he had a theory that the earth was expanding from the inside and getting bigger, and that's why dinosaurs were bigger back in the day, because the earth was smaller, so there's less gravity. It's not a theory that's founded in any reality or any science. We talked a little bit about it in the Discord, so I won't get into it here, because I do think it is a dark smudge on what was otherwise a really stellar and important career in comics.
But that's what I'm saying. Then we got past it.
It's almost irrelevant to me. Yeah, it's like whatever, you know.
And that's why I just wanted to you know, I'm aware of it. We've talked about it on the Discord. I'm not going to get into it here just because I don't think this is the time or the place to do it.
I mean, Neil Adams thought the world was getting bigger. Josh thinks people in pun should be killed. Like, we all have our quirks.
Yeah. I remember hearing, it was an old Word Balloon interview with Neil Adams, where he told some story about how he found out, I can't remember which of the two companies he was working for, but he found out like the guys they were buying their colored ink from, like they were giving the guys across the street twice the colors for the same price. And so like he just went and argued with them until they gave him the same deal. And I love little stories like that, where it's like he seemed like a guy who just would not tolerate injustice or unfairness and would go to the mat and fight for what he felt was right. And I really respect that. And I think, you know, the landscape of comics would not be the same if he had not been there fighting the whole time he was in the game.
Yeah, and I don't want to shortchange him at all, obviously, even though we spent, like, I could spend hours talking about Perez because I was living it in real time. But, like, you know, we actually did a book split on Neil Adams last year, I think, Josh. We did the Batman Neil Adams book split. And you go back and you look at his pages and what he did. It's almost like the leap from everyone else to Kirby is the leap from everyone else to Neil Adams, because what he did was just explode the idea of what you could do with a comic book page.
He picked up that ball and ran it further down the field. Whereas like you could look at Ditko, and Ditko is working in the same universe as Kirby, but just had this another amazing style. So he was a contemporary, you know, and then Adams was the guy who was like, well, where do we take it from here? And he was, I think, the first one to really advance that. And you know, we've said this many times, but if you look at those pages, those 60s and 70s Neil Adams pages and the layouts and his, you know, figure drawing and his, you know, just it's leagues ahead of where it was. And it would still, if it came out in a book today, the way he was drawing then, not necessarily the way he was drawing when he was in his 70s, which still had hints of it, but that stuff back then was flawless, you know, and you would think it was beautiful if it came out in a book today.
He brought a sense of realism where, you know, you look at this
double-edged sword.
Sure, but you look at the art of the Golden Age and the early Silver Age, you're looking at cartooning, right? You're not like, oh, look, that character, the Flash looks real. Like, but Neil Adams brought a sense of adding, you know, realistic anatomy and things that you never lost a sense that it wasn't looking like Alex Ross. You never lost a sense that these are drawings on a paper, but it was still more realistic than
it was so
you
much
were
more
used to.
Dynamic, yeah. Than realistic. I mean, I'm picturing, I don't remember what it's from, but I'm always, there's a Batman and he's running across the
desert. The one who's running across the desert, right, everybody?
His left hand is way down in the left-hand corner, mm-hmm. of the page, and you know, it goes diagonally up towards the right as his cape sort of flies that way.
Yeah.
You know, and there's an energy in his panel layouts and his, you know, posing. It just takes that foreshortening that Kirby made the standard and you know, added a lot more technique to it. Is that sound like the right thing? I mean, I feel like Kirby was imagination and Neil Adams was technique, you know, and that's sort of where they meet in the middle.
And he, you know, he loved those big overwrought, like we talked about this in the Booksplode about how his character work was almost like from melodramatic soap opera, like everyone was really feeling all their emotions, but it really worked.
Like in, the sad, distraught Batman under his mask, and you could tell, like, oh!
And it just really, it was this really dynamic sense of storytelling. And I think as a kid, you know, first of all, you know you like something, and you don't necessarily know why you like it. You know, you're, in that sense. Like, I remember when I was 11 and 12 when Batman 89 came out, and they put out a bunch of collections. You know, collections were not necessarily things that they put out all the time, but back then they put out the Greatest Batman Stories Ever Told, Volume 1 and 2, and the Greatest Joker Stories Ever Told. And I bought those, of course. I still have them. And they were, looking back now, they're full of Neil Adams. They're full of them.
Yes.
And they were stories I loved reading over and over and over as a kid. I probably read those books 100, 200 times, but I didn't know what I was looking at. I just knew I was responding to it. And I didn't know why. And I don't even know really who was doing it. But when I open them up now, I'm like, oh, look, that's a Neil Adams story. And I remember loving that story as a kid. And that's another Neil Adams story. And so he is also all over my childhood in a way I didn't understand at the time because I was maybe slightly too young. But
I very much remember having one of the first graphic novels I bought was The Greatest Joker Stories Ever Told. And that's because I couldn't find the Batman Stories Ever Told anywhere. So I got the Joker one. And those ones the ones that he did were the ones that I was like, wow. I mean, even as a 12-year-old, mm-hmm. you know, and those stood out to me then. And so that's where he first made a mark on me, probably before I knew who Perez was.
Right.
Because they just looked so much better than every other thing in that book. It's cool. And I was into, like, Todd McFarlane at the time, so.
And Frank Miller gets the credit, rightly, for The Dark Knight Returns and making Batman serious. But really, if you go look back, it starts with Neil Adams and Denny O'Neill, you know, trying to take Batman in a different tonal place post Silver Age, post Batman 66. And they've gotten fully where Frank Miller went and therefore everything else after, but they have to be part of the conversation of making Batman into who he was. Batman in the 70s wasn't a very popular character. You know, he wasn't. Which is crazy to think now, but it isn't. It's true.
I still remember the first time I really understood sort of how Neil Adams changed the game was I was already in college and I picked up a Dead Man collection that had some of the earliest stories drawn by Carmine Infantino, who's I think probably my favorite Golden Age artist.
Love Carmine Infantino.
And then it transitioned, but the transition from those issues into Neil Adams, I mean, it's night and day.
Oh yeah.
That's
actually why I said Flash earlier. I was thinking about Carmine Infantino, like. Yeah, for sure. Go ahead.
Just the explosion of details and textures and emotions, you know, like the stuff you guys have been saying when you transition from Carmine's early work into what Neil Adams did with the character. And I now think it's fair to say that, you know, Dead Man is more associated with Neil Adams than Carmine or his the original writer. So,
yeah, it's a huge loss for the industry and a huge loss for just, you know, Every all these pros came out after Perez died with stories about how he would have conversations with them and buck them up when they were feeling down or praise their work and they would you know they would fly away, you know, like it seems like again I don't know why we never interviewed Perez. I mean, we just interviewed so many people over the years and we definitely did Neil Adams. I just don't remember why we never did George Perez. It could be also he just wasn't around. He started getting sick in 2013.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were doing stuff from 7 to...
Yeah, no, I don't know why. Maybe he just was doing cross-gen. I think it was a whole bit, in the beginning, he was at cross-gen. I don't think we want to talk about that stuff, but it's just a huge loss for the industry. It's a huge loss for the world, the humanity, and Neil Adams felt like one of those like immortal people. You know, he never looked his age. He always looked like he was. He looked kind of still like it was 1956, and he was still young. And he was very. He was very. You know, his hair was black. He had. He was very vibrant. He came off as younger than his age, so it felt like he'd be around forever. And Perez feels like a contemporary. So it just feels just the. It's a bummer, and it's going to be a bummer as these things start happening in the next few years.
And but you know. What can we do about it? What do I feel good about? Like, we keep talking.
You find
about
a cure for cancer, Josh.
No, I mean I could do that, but instead I'm thinking about immolating punsters. No, but I mean, like, I feel like if nothing else, like, we've made sure to at least to a small group of people who enjoy comics to make sure that we keep those names and their influences to the forefront. I feel really good about that, and I think we should keep. You know, I will keep doing that. But you know, it is a great thing to be. You know, person who talks about comic books and that people are sort of paying attention to and be able to be like, no, look at this Neil Adams stuff, and then have other people discover it and they get that, you know, they realize it. You know, it's when you see when everything clicks into place and you go, oh, that is something special, you know. So, you know, be a curator of that legacy, of that sort of work and how it connects to it. And
yeah, I think curator is a great word for sort of the role that we can play in this space, is to just make sure. Yeah, well put.
Yeah, it's going to be, you know, like, and I was thinking about, you know, there was the whole Justice League Avengers collection that just came out recently. And I even think that the miniseries itself is really only happens because someone like Perez is involved with it. You know, someone who everyone likes in the industry. And it's, and Perez always wanted to finish that because, you know, he started that, you know, decades before the miniseries actually happened. And he always wanted it to happen. And I think that's a good reason why it did. And it's a good reason why there was a new collection out. Things that we enjoy happen because of people like that. And, you know, it's just a bummer. Just a bummer.
I guarantee you that if you were to look through any collection of George Perez's work, you would not. You just, it's an absolute, you would not find a page where like, oof, he phoned this one in. It wouldn't happen. He'd right. be like, I'm going to put some extra heads in there.
Right.
Like, that's how he would work. He would overdo things. He would never underdo them.
Yeah.
And it works. Yeah. It's fun.
So there you go. Toast to Neil Adams and George Perez, two of our favorites and two giants in the industry, and their loss will be felt. So obviously we skipped the email section to talk about Adams and Perez, but contact@ifanboy.com is where you can write in for this show or for the Media Explode show. If it's for the Media Explode show, please put it into the subject line of the email. Out now, Josh and Paul Montgomery and I talked about Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. You can find that show right behind this one on the feed. We had three different opinions, so just FYI. Nobody write to us to say you guys, because it was three different opinions. Mm-hmm. Coming up the rest of this month, in May, Josh should have a Talksplode. There will be a Media Explode. The Media Explode should be coming out actually maybe this coming week, I think, possibly. We haven't recorded it yet, but that's on the schedule. And then in the beginning of June, Ryan and Paul and I will talk about DC Showcase Constantine. And there's a subtitle. I don't remember what it is, but that one slipped by us. It came out already, but we've just been so busy that we'll get to that one in June. It'll be happening. Don't you worry. And Ryan, why don't you talk about your show?
I mean, I'm a little worried, but that's not.
I'm a little worried too.
That's not the viewers' problems. And I think we need to table whether or not they're viewers. ScienceSortOf.com is my podcast. I recently recorded an episode with J. Kenji Lopez Alt of The Food Lab and Serious Eats and New York Times. He's a food guy, food science guy. He has a new book out all about the wok. So if you are interested in learning how to cook with a wok, but also just my kind of science food chat with him, that should be coming down your feed soonly.
All right.
You can find out about all of our shows at ifanboy.com, as well as the archive of years of great comic book writing from our large, varied, and talented staff. You can find out what the pick of the week is before the show comes out by following @ifanboy on Twitter or @ifanboycomics on Instagram. Follow us individually, C.S. Kilpatrick, J.A. Flanagan, and Ryan Haupt on Instagram, and just Haupt, H-A-U-P-T. On Twitter, you can subscribe to our YouTube page at youtube.com/ifanboy to keep up to date with the old video show re-uploads. The full-length shows are all uploaded and stored just down to our minis. This past week, we have the pick of the week, The Roberts, number one. Did a second issue never come out of that?
I don't remember.
Is that the one?
Well,
I think it was a
Pretty Baby Machine was the famous one.
Oh, okay, okay. Maybe there was a second Roberts. It was about the Zodiac Killer and the Strangler.
Was it was the Boston Strangler, and something else, both named Robert.
Okay. Maybe there was a second one that finished it. I think it was a 2-issue series. And the new comics preview. You're sitting around. You're thinking, I know what comics came out this week. What about September 10th, 2008? And what did those guys think about it back then? Well, I got good news for you, pal. You can go to YouTube and you can find out. How many views does something like that get?
Not many.
Five, eight?
There were two issues of the Roberts. It was a 2-issue miniseries. Uh-huh. They both came out.
Yeah.
And it was about the Boston Strangler and the Zodiac Killer being in a, living in a retirement home together. And it was
that's
terrific.
That's a great pitch. You could pitch that to me again right now, and I'd say sign me up. Okay, I'll buy that. 100%.
Yeah. Where are we? Yeah, no, those don't get very many views, which understandably. Next week is more exciting in terms of those shows. Before I move on, we never said whether or not we were going to continue reading the Jurassic League as a series. Are we sticking with it?
I'm going to say probably no, but that's not 100% no.
I don't think I will.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm torn because I really love Daniel Warren Johnson, but it doesn't feel like his fingerprints are on the book very much, other than a few things here and there. So I don't know. It's going to be a game time decision, like Josh.
Yeah.
Hey, if you like the show, please consider leaving a review or a star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Even better, that's word of mouth. Tell your friends, your mom, your kids, your letter carrier, the person who sells you donuts, the cop giving you a speeding ticket.
I love
anybody.
Her.
Just tell them. Tell them about the show. Maybe they'll like it. You don't know. Don't assume they won't. Don't be full of assumptions, or Josh might burn you. I don't know how he feels about people who assume things.
I didn't say burn assumption people.
I don't
know.
I'm just
punning.
At this point,
if you're punning, you know what you're doing.
So that's it for this week's show. Thank you, Ryan, for joining us in the third chair.
Anytime.
And thank you all for listening. Until next week, I'm Connor.
I'm Ryan.
Let me check here. Yep, Josh Flanagan. That's me.
Stay safe out there. Go slow. I fall behind. The second.